KQ4LJY listening.
KQY, KD2BG, how you doing?
Station calling. I didn't get your call sign. It broke up. KQ4LJY. Doing okay?
JY, this is KD2BG. Yeah, I'm doing all right. How are you?
Well, you kind of faded in and out again. This is John here.
Yeah, I can boost transmitter power. I don't know if I want to.
Pretty good there. Whenever we use our call signs, that's usually when it fades, right?
45 watts right here. This might be a bit much.
Pretty good. Now I got Kilo Delta, I believe.
Delta 2 Bravo November Golf.
Afternoon, KD2BNG. This is KQ4LJY. John here.
4LJY. Let me write that down. So, John, what's up?
Sir, getting ready for a birthday coming up on the 25th and reaching out, talking with some friends here back and forth and testing out my power. I think I'm coming at you on the repeater, probably about, I don't know, 20 watts.
Repeater is funny. I've got into it as few as 5 watts. I could go back to 5 watts and see if that works, but you said it was a bit weak.
Try it right now. You're full silencing.
30 watts. I'm causing interference to the. I'm pretty close to the TV antenna. Okay, let's drop back. About 5 watts. I don't really have any in between position.
Just a little noise in the background. Just a little fade.
VHF radio, so it's either full power or almost nothing. But. All right, well, we'll stay at 40 watts.
I can hear you okay at the moment, so you're getting ready for Christmas as well.
Well, if by that you mean that I have to, let's see. Yeah, I guess I did all my Christmas shopping. I don't have any gifts planned for anyone this year, probably not even including myself. I don't really have any money to spend.
Understand that on the money side, it's pretty tight these days. I thought maybe you had you some new ham equipment coming, maybe.
I think it's on eBay. There's a, it was a mobile radio made by Anytone, I think. I assume they're Chinese. The 10-meter radio. And they also make that, there's a quad bander for like 10, 6, 2, and 70 centimeters, FM only. But I don't really need any. I don't really need any more equipment.
Stand. I'm a little leery on eBay. I'm attracted to it. I guess you don't know what kind of abuse or not someone's put through that machine. You know.
Private party people selling ham stuff on eBay. You know, a lot of times if they leave their call sign, you know, hams aren't generally going to try to screw fellow hams with bad equipment. Now, of course, a lot of it is just other random sellers, so it's luck of the draw. This radio came from, this might have come from another ham. Most of the equipment I've gotten, I've had reasonably okay luck with.
I understand that, I suppose, I think what you're saying is probably pretty true. If you're getting it from another ham, often you're probably doing okay.
This is actually one of two identical radios sitting here. They're commercial radios, both made by Midland. I got a VHF model and a UHF model. I should get an antenna splitter of some sort and try to, very few UHF repeaters here, not a lot on 70 centimeters. I think there's two or three that actually have traffic on them.
ID jumped on you, but I could hear you okay. Yeah, that's probably true. You might get something out of 220 there.
Stability I don't have, and is there even a repeater? I think there was one.
Affirmative, there is one. I'm talking to you on an Ocean 980P quad bander. Works pretty good.
I don't know that particular radio, but, you know, it sounds okay.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, and like I said, I'm not coming at you at any high power. It's pretty nice radio, quad bander. No affiliation by two-way radios. I picked it up from them, and it's been a solid radio.
As I said, I think I got enough radios. I have probably two or three HF sets that basically sit here because, I don't know, one of these days I should actually go up and try to put up another HF antenna.
Good kind of job if you got somebody that's one of them rock climbers. They can skinny up a tree pretty easy and get down all in one piece, you know.
Utility poles, probably about 20 feet high, 25 feet high, and they're about 100 feet apart. So, I mean, I could get a wire between the two of them. You know, what you do is you attach the wire to a little tiny flimsy pole and then nail that pole to the bigger pole. Because obviously the alternative is trying to shimmy up the pole, and you don't want to do that. So, you know, use the small little bit of little piece of wood and nail it to the bigger piece of wood. And, you know, do that on both sides to get the antenna. I had it running between the two utility poles at one time, but it sort of blew down on the one side, and I never put it back up again.
Well, that makes a lot of sense doing it that way for darn sure. I helped a buddy of mine set one up, and he was he also had two utility poles, and we set up two flagpole pulley systems up there, nylon pulley systems on both poles, and now he can run them up and down, whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, I could devise some other system for, you know, an HF antennas don't even have to be that big. I have those hamstick antennas, I think for 75 meters and 40 meters. I could probably even do something with those. You know, they need a metal ground plane. So, you know, I have this old van parked near the house. It's not going anywhere. Put them on the roof of the van, if nothing else.
That sounds like a plan for sure. Absolutely.
Foot shipping container. That's probably a better ground plane. Because that's, you know, like quarter inch steel.
Buddy couldn't get up on the pole, and neither of us wanted to use those pole climber pegs they use to climb with, so he got a loader, and the loader got us pretty close to the top of that. Just had to ride in a bucket with a safety strap, you know?
If good HF antenna doesn't even really have to be that high. Well, wait, there is a relationship between, well, let's see, that changes if it's horizontal or vertical. I think it has to be at least an eighth of a wavelength above the ground. I don't know the formula, but, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be that high, but as high as you can get it.
You're right. I think he was trying to get at least 25 foot.
It should be a quarter of a wavelength or an eighth to a quarter of a wavelength above the ground. Otherwise, you get mostly a ground wave pattern. Then again, there was another problem with it being too high. So I forget what the formula is for the optimal height. And now that, you know, that's if it's horizontal. If it's vertical, you know, who knows? When I get a chance, I'll do something about putting an HF antenna back up.
Absolutely. That sounds like a plan. I got a buddy of mine right now. He's looking at a 10 meter. He's working on that.
The copper tubing J-folds. And it isn't really even outside. It's in the corner of the bedroom, just lying against the wall. you know, in the corner where the two walls come together, just lie, you know, prop it up against the wall. But, you know, it's a non-ferrous wall, so, and there's no other electronics nearby, so it works okay. The thing about the J-pole, I think, is, you know, take four or five loops of coax and make a little choke, right, you know, not far from the feed point.
I understand that. I'm talking on you, a collinear antenna, a diamond, and oops, on mine to allow me to decouple, more or less. I do have the radios, but they're not big enough to provide what they need to do. It's under the roof of a house, and I'm still reaching out to you.
What I was thinking of doing is building another J-pole. Let's see. Take the 2-meter one and scale it up by a factor of 5 to make a 10-meter J-pole. That's going to get big. You know, the long element is going to be like 24 feet long, and the other one is going to be 8 foot long. So that's going to be a big antenna, and I'm not exactly sure where to mount it.
Goodness, you're right about that. I've got HOA to deal with, so I have to kind of camouflage anything I'm doing. Trying to buy a piece of property in the woods next to me, and that would give me a solution for everything I want to do.
HOA here, which I guess is good. And, yeah, well, it depends how much room, you know, what the house where you're at now, you know, how much property you have where you could really build some sprawling antenna system. Actually, you don't need that much acreage either, do you?
True, too. It's just how you manipulate it around, you know, your property.
Hey, in Long Island, I had, the house was sitting on maybe like a quarter to half acre lot. So behind the house, there was maybe 60 foot. Yeah, I suppose I could have done something for maybe 60 foot, maybe 40 meters, maybe a bit longer. But there again, you know, your nearest neighbor is like 20 or 30 feet away, and I'm sure one of them is going to complain. Hey, what's that thing? You got to get rid of that.
Said that right. A friend, I've got to go out to his place, but he did something, I don't know exactly, pardon my ignorance, with the gutter system on his house and built an antenna, and I'm still trying to figure that one out.
About that. The original antenna, I mentioned the end-fed long wire that was going between the two utility poles. The reception on that thing actually was fair, but it actually got better one day, and then I realized why it got better. It had already fallen down on one side and coupled to the rain gutter.
JY, well, maybe that's the solution, I guess, on the receive. What about the transmit side?
Yeah, that I don't know. I mean, it was a random length of, you know, a random length end-fed wire, so it had to go to the antenna tuner in the machine anyway. So I guess I just said, okay, I don't know why this is off. You know, just sit here a minute and retune it. But I didn't realize that it already, one side had already sank down, and it was coupled to the rain gutter. Oh, wow, it improved when it fell on the rain gutter.
Understood. What kind of rig were you using for your HF on that?
Isu, what was it? I don't have it on the desk. It's still in the box. Isu rig from, like, the mid to late 90s. Is there an 890 something AT? It's the one that had a built-in antenna tuner.
That could be. I know a couple buddy of mine have jumped on them ICOMs, and they're very nice radios.
YC 718. That's the one that's sitting on the desk here. I guess pretty much for decoration.
Instead of a lava lamp, you can look at the waterfall.
Waterfall displays, I'm sure, are a lot of money, though. I mean, you could spend upwards of $2,000 or $3,000, I guess, on a halfway decent radio. I'd rather put that money in the antenna system. I'd rather have a $100 radio and a $1,000 antenna system than the other way around.
Yep, that's 100% affirmative on that idea. Yep, it's in the antenna, right? Yeah, I tell you, those are pretty nice. A dear buddy of mine got one of those with the waterfall, and it cost him more money because now he's running around his house trying to find out where he's getting stray RF.
Yaesu FT890, and that was an 890AT, with or without the built-in antenna tuner. 160 to 10 meters, general coverage from 100 kilohertz to 30 megahertz, 100 watts on CW and sideband and FM, and 25 watts on AM. And I'm thinking from the design, like mid-90s or so, decent radio. I have it. It's in the box. It's probably going to stay in the box, but I should take that one out and set it up, because that's the only one that I have that has FM. And I think I can set it up for a split on FM for, I guess, the top of 10 meters.
But you bumped my head on that one. If you get all that stuff working there, get her out of the box, right? Because those things will last a long time. Yaesu's pretty darn solid radio as well.
Yes, HF radio I have. I have the SICOM 718. There's one other somewhere. But yeah, that'd be a good reason to get them, get the antenna system working, is like, get them out of the box and do something with them.
W4EEY, Gary, by chance?
All signs sound familiar.
4EEY.
Don't really know him. Probably have spoken to him on this repeater. Call sign is familiar.
He's one heck of a gentleman, I'll tell you that. If you ever go online and look him up, he does a lot of the training and classes, and that man's been all over the world to work with military radio systems, and if I'm not misrepresenting him and such, but just a wonderful person. I always use him to bounce my tech questions off, and he's never let me down.
Call sign sounds familiar. I may have spoken to him or not on this repeater. I could look him up on QRZ, I suppose.
I think of him as sort of a super helmet. That's my opinion. But wonderful person, and just a pleasure to talk to every time. He makes a lot of DX contacts.
It's probably one of the ones on this repeater at like 5 a.m. in the morning. Bragging about, I just worked a guy in Afghanistan today on 17. Peter, sometimes you'll hear some very early morning traffic from people trying to catch, stations in odd places.
He'd never known him to brag too much. I know when him and I were talking, he had mentioned that when the weather was right, he was actually talking to people in Africa.
I've made with this radio, and actually I didn't make it with using this radio. Someone else was borrowing the radio, but I think I was there at the time. It was some contact in Bulgaria, and I think it was on 40 meters. I loaned this to another ham who's a silent key, KI4MLN, so he probably knew more about the rig than I did. Yeah, I was talking to this guy in Bulgaria. Or no, I don't know if I was listening to it or not. I can't remember.
It was a pretty long DXQ, so for that, Bulgaria's a piece, probably, 7,000 miles or better, 7,500?
Sounds about right.
I hadn't got there yet myself, but I've been messing around here trying to get in touch with NA1SS.
I really don't who that is.
It's a call sign for the U.S. people on the space station that goes around. I'm trying to get in touch with them to make a QSO contact. And also, they've got a repeater on board, and I'm curious to see how far I can bounce off that repeater to somewhere else.
International Space Station, that's their call sign. They have, I don't think they got a voice repeater. They got a digipeater. You can reach them on, you know, packet mode or some other, you know, some digital mode. There might have been a regular 2-meter voice repeater. I don't know if it still exists. But, yeah, and I'm sure you could reach someone on the station directly if anyone happens to be listening. Every once in a while, they would do that that presentation for classrooms around the world, you know, live from the International Space Station or whatever. And at least one of the uplink frequencies, I think, was on 2 meters. So, you know, once or twice I've heard them.
That, they did get a voice repeater on that ARISS, I guess I'm saying that right, ARISS. And they're talking through a Kenwood D710GA. And it's on 145.990 PL67 up.
If they ever happen to be overhead. ideally, I would need some motorized antenna that can track them. I could probably build one of those as well, a satellite tracking antenna. I only heard them once when they were passing directly overhead, and only a fragment of conversation, maybe a sentence or two, because I guess by that time the antenna had already rotated the other way to a different orientation, or it had already gone by.
Q4LJY. Yeah, I normally catch them coming out the west. I sign up, they'll send me Texas. Text message, I should say, when the lat long is close to me. They got about 6 minutes overhead, and I've heard them talking for, oh gosh, probably a couple minutes. You know, moving at, what, about 17,000 miles an hour, they get it.
Like a base station or a handheld. I've actually seen videos of someone working the satellites using a couple of handheld radios and just physically grabbing the antenna and moving it. You know, trying to track the satellite.
I use that Diamond Collinear, but I tend to get great gain coming out the west when they're coming my way, and I lose them about time they get overhead, you know, because I'm not pointing at them.
See, I could probably find them right now. The N2IO website, I think. Let me see if he's, N2IO.com, and there is the anytime now. It'll show a, okay, there's a map, and there's a track of something. But, yeah, this thing will track a bunch of other satellites as well.
I go to www.esa.int. And ESA has a tracker, looks like right now they're cutting across the Panama Central, between the U.S. and South America.
Maybe I got to refresh the page, but let's see. Let's see. 23 South, 100.9 West, 421 kilometers, right ascension, declination, yeah. Oh, that's the space station. I'm trying to figure out how to get all the other satellites.
Stand corrected. I was looking at an old picture. I do have them, LAT 22-6 South, 109 East. Actually, they're going, oh gosh, over towards Malaysia and stuff. I know I said Central U.S. I was wrong on that.
There's a little icon that shows it. Somewhere off the west coast of Australia.
That's affirmative. Headed towards, look like, Singapore and Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Aleutian Islands. It'll be almost directly overhead. That's the end of the track that I see. But yeah, I think I heard them once when they were passing, and they have to be almost directly overhead. You know, unless, again, you've got a steerable, you know, trackable antenna.
I concur. If you look at their history, they weren't too far off of us. I had a 6 o'clock in the morning alert. You can sign up for text messages now, and it will send you a text message in advance when it's going to be near your lat long, which I think is a nice feature.
My lat long is going by my IP address, which is somewhere else. But this is close to where I am, 3522 minus 8084 west. All right. Yeah, I got to have it. But yeah, they'll do that. And how long is the ISS even going to be up there? There's plans in the next couple of years to deorbit it.
I've heard similar to that, which is why I'm trying to make that QSO with them in case they abandon the project. But I think a lot of it has to do with funding, and of course, you know, our Russian friends are up there, and there's a lot of issues politically, you know.
Relations with nobody right now, especially the U.S. Although, you know, usually science was the one area of international cooperation that usually was above everything. You know, our scientists still talk to each other, even if nobody else does. The track of this thing must have stopped. But, yeah, the ISS already is like 25 years old or more. When did it go up? In the late 90s? It might have been completed by 2000 or so. So it's getting near the end of its lifespan anyway.
True. I had heard they were talking about building modules to couple to it and use it as a sort of a backup, if you would. But that all kind of fell through the pipes, too.
That was a plan to attach some sort of booster and lift the perigee of the orbit a bit higher, because, you know, it periodically does, at that altitude, it's not entirely above the atmosphere. I think it periodically needs orbital maneuvers now to keep its orbit.
It was a company that built or prototyped some special plasma engines that they could have put on board of that or attached to, but I don't think that went anywhere either.
At the end of its useful life, then, I guess. Plus, I think there was other problems developing. There was a leak in the Russian side of the thing that no one ever found. One of the Russian modules, it either got hit by a piece of space debris or what happened to it. There's electrical system problems. It was all other kind of problems.
Tell you what, when you see that space junk map up there, it's kind of scary. They're like, I don't know, they're just thousands of pieces of junk flying around up there.
Actually, of some concern. I forget what it was called, but someone was worried about, well, you know, two or more pieces of space junk colliding and making a cascade effect, where the shrapnel hits more things, and they make more and more shrapnel that hits other things. So, but yeah, for now, all the junk seems to be orbiting okay.
To fall into the Swiss cheese model of failure.
The Apollo 13 failure, multiple cascade failure. Something causes something else, causes something else to fail. And the original failure is minor, but the results usually aren't.
Affirmative, I work on aircraft, and that's what we talk about, but you can do failure mode analysis all day long. It's the unforeseen that throws a monkey wrench in the mix.
One of those where, for a while, Mission Control was saying, this can't be happening. There's no way that these three or four or five or, you know, that many things failed at once. What I think is that there was some heater in the O2 tank that overheated because something else was incorrectly installed, and that ruptured the O2 tank, which ruptured another O2 tank, and, you know, cascade failure.
If that tank's a LOX tank, I don't know what they're using, then that creates a whole nother set of parameters.
Probably look it up, but there was they call it a fan. I don't know what it is really, but it's supposed to stir the locks inside the tank so it doesn't freeze. And something about that was a tank that had previously been installed, I think, on Apollo 10, and another tank was procured for Apollo 10. That one was removed, and it dropped like maybe half a meter and hit the ground. But it looked okay, so we put it in Apollo 13. Also, the voltage specifications, they had changed it from a 28 to 60-volt system. And, you know, nobody told the supplier of the tank heater. So there was some over-voltage to the tank heater. It wasn't, you know, entirely a spontaneous failure. There were, like, administrative failures that led up to this.
4LJY. Yeah, that voltage change was probably tied into having new solar panels on there. I remember it seems like they were doing some battery changes and some upgrades, so that probably was involved. And goodness gracious, people don't realize that depending upon where that leak is, if it's external, then now they have a means of propulsion that they don't want.
Panels on Apollo? I doubt it. But they probably had to beef up the electrical system for other reasons. Maybe they realized Apollo 11 or 10 or whatever had insufficient power. But, yeah, and that's also a source of propulsion. What happened right after is, you know, the control, the thing does start to tumble out of control, and I think that's because the computer control attached to the RCS system suddenly says, "Hey man, we're moving," and it's trying to fire off all these thrusters to try to compensate for this rolling and yawing and whatever's going on. I don't know how they finally got it stabilized. But that might have also been the command module computer doing that. I could find out more about that. I've forgotten a lot of details.
The panels I was speaking to were on the space station themselves.
But the other one, the other one that could have been rescued if they'd gotten the other space station that could have been possibly put to better use, I think, was Skylab. There was only ever, like, four missions ever made to Skylab. And there was a mission to rescue that by putting another booster on it using the space shuttle, but the space shuttle wasn't ready yet. But, yeah, so, you know, the ISS, it'll go down as well, and we'll build something better.
For some talk, one of these Musk rockets about doing something with it too, so I don't know, you know. I mean, if they're going to abandon it, I'm sure some industry would say, hey, you know, turn it over to us. They'll do something with it, you know.
Maybe. I guess the question is it, you know, is it salvageable in its current form? Or is there too much repair that needs to be done to make it worthwhile to repurpose for something else? Plus, as I said, I think the orbit is going to decay eventually anyway. There was talk of attaching something, some booster to boost it into a somewhat higher orbit. You know, it's a question of, at this point, what do you want this thing for?
Yeah, all true. All facts true on that. I'm not exactly what they do up there, short of these experiments. Back in the day, lived out in California. I was a kid with my dad when they did that Snoopy mission. And a lot of things go on that they don't put on TV, you know.
Question of whether you know, it's like nobody ever has 24/7 coverage of any mission, because you know mostly it's a lot of boring routine things. So yeah, we're going to broadcast the portions of the mission that are actually interesting. You know, who knows? Maybe the space station will make it into a luxury space hotel or something. We'll have for $1 billion, you can come and stay at the orbiting space hotel.
Be a offset to another project. I know my father was out at Goldstone NASA tracking stations, YSA, and I got to go out there with him when this was going on, the moon mission, and the TV had the astronauts on it, and then all of a sudden it said secure, so they shut it down for whatever it is they were doing.
I don't know. As far as I know, I don't know why they would ever, I don't know why they would ever have reason to do that, but, so you're saying at some point NASA cut off the live feed, or somebody did?
They did, as I recall. Then again, I think I was about 12 years old or something then. They were talking, and the news were talking, and then it said that the astronauts were going to sleep, and then all of a sudden, they went off air with it, and then went secure.
Well, it means they stopped broadcasting, or stopped retransmitting the broadcast. As exciting as going to the moon is, I suppose at some time you got to take a nap.
That's also a true statement. I figured, though, they wouldn't have the whole crew napping. It's probably, working almost like a military combat naps. You know, somebody's up for a certain amount of time and they rotate,
Remember, you're dealing with something that's on a ballistic trajectory. We pointed in this direction and it's going to go. So an actual 8-hour cockpit shift might involve 30 minutes of actual work. Okay, check on these systems, do a few little maintenance procedures, and, then go back to bed if you want to. It's not like we're going to hit some major emergency. Well, in the case of Apollo 13, maybe. But, you're on a ballistic trajectory toward the moon. You're not going to blow off course or something.
Yep, that's a fact. That's a fact. And pretty much everybody in the world and every monitor and every system's out there supposed to be guarding it. But, to this day, they still like live people landing airplanes. And, autopilots seem to work pretty well these days.
Yes. On a long journey, more than an hour or two, probably do most of the flying. Autopilot tends to work well. They're probably almost at the point where they could even probably try to land the plane. But yeah, if I'm on an 8-hour, 12-hour flight, that's pretty much what I'm going to do. And then take a nap, or have people napping in shifts, so at least maybe one person is awake. But yeah, then the autopilot will get you there.
I already have the technology to land the plane. It's just whether or not people want to trust that. I would. I have no issue with that. It's good technology, and there's enough fail-safes there, redundancy there, to where unless all the stars align in the wrong way, it works good and lasts a long time.
Self-driving cars and say, why would you want to do that to aircraft? Well, you got to understand something, too. The problem with aircraft is a whole lot simpler. There aren't that many other planes in your immediate air corridor. You're pretty much going down a predetermined flight path. It's not like a dog or a small child is going to run out in the middle of the road. So it's a simpler problem, you know, for an aircraft than it is for an automobile. You know, plus there's always more than one guidance system. Satellite navigation fails, I think you still have inertial guidance. Inertial guidance, for that somehow to fail, I think you've still got a compass. So, there's usually some backup guidance system as well.
Understood, KQ4LJY. Yeah, that's true. Everything's tuned in so much to satellites now. The big problem we have in aviation is that the aircrew pilots are spending more time into the panels than they are paying attention to other things.
Well, there again, you know, if everybody is in their appropriately assigned air corridor, and, you know, the autopilot is flying the plane within fairly narrow course parameter, you know, there shouldn't be too many surprises. But, yeah, of course, you do want to be watching out for that. Humans usually suck at monitoring things, though. That's the danger of autopilot is complacency. But, yeah, autopilot technology has been around, I don't know how many years. I'm going to guess in some way or another 50 years or more. And, you know, doesn't usually fail unless somehow you tell it to go to the wrong place or you tell it to start from the wrong place. I think that's what happened to that Korean Airlines flight that was shot down over Japan in 83 or 84. It had the wrong coordinates programmed in.
That's correct. As I understand it, the aircraft had three INS systems. Air crew was running late, and they auto-filled. They input an error into one, and they auto-filled the other two, so the error carried over.
There's redundant systems, or there's more than one system. So you put the numbers into the one guidance computer, and then push a button that says transfer all the numbers everywhere else. Yeah, so if there's an error in the original... But there was a whole comedy of errors going on that day. There was some VOR beacon in Anchorage that wasn't working that day, which could have told them, you know, you're not where you think you are. There just happened to be a missile test that day, and they happened to be flying over very near a Russian missile base shortly after or shortly before that test was due to be scheduled. Also, you had an American spy plane in that location just an hour or so before. So that's who the Russian fighters maybe thought they were after. It was just a combination of factors, you know, none of these factors by itself wouldn't have mattered. It was just a bad coincidence.
Yep, that's exactly right. You know, reportedly someone had said that they thought that intelligence gathering aircraft was trying to fly the radar shadow of the airliner, and I'm like, well, okay, that's possible, but that normally if it's an intel airplane, you would want to make a visual on it before you launch to shoot it down, but that's the Russian way of doing it, you know, force.
Understand too, though, Russian Air Command and Russian Command in general is a lot more centralized. So their field, which is why these planes were flying after the thing for close to 2 to 3 hours before they shot at it. Okay, must radio Moscow. What to do now? So you got the chain of command going all the way back, and you know things. Things get lost in transmission or whatever. Misunderstandings occur. But that was kind of always the weakness of the... Probably still is the weakness of the Russian command system.
Yeah, that could be. I think, you know, having spent a lot of time in the military, they saw the airplane fixing to leave their airspace, and it was either now or never. One of those kind of things, you know?
I don't know. I do know that, from what I understand of it, field commanders have a lot less discretion than, let's say, American or European field commanders. You know, I can't take a dump without reporting back to Moscow. You know, let's say I'm a commander in Afghanistan. The Afghans are attacking. What do I do? I don't even have necessarily that layer of that much discretion. The command structure always was that way, going back to Tsarist times, because the government was always a little bit afraid of the military.
That's why good doctrine, military doctrine would dictate you go after leadership, because then the low people on the totem pole are a little bit lost and confused.
The Russians always feared, especially from the Americans. Especially in the 80s, when Americans, what we went from Polaris or Poseidon to Trident, the Trident nuclear subs supposedly had better accuracy, so they were always afraid of some sort of decapitation strike against command bunkers. You know, and then the average Russian commander is, okay, what do we really do now? But, let me let this drop a minute. I read about something a while back. This may also even go back to the 80s, early 90s. The Russians were so afraid of this system that they had a system called Perimeter, which, you know, if Perimeter is switched on, and if its array, the array of sensors detect, you know, atmospheric, radiation, pressure sensors, seismic sensors all over the country, if the system is switched on, and if the sensors detect anything like an explosion, nuclear explosion, this thing can automatically start retaliating. You know, and there's a scary possibility.
Smokes, that scares me even more, thinking all these people want to introduce AI into it. There's a lot of room for error there, you know.
Well, you know, it's the system. What is it? It's officially denied, or, you know, we don't know if it exists or not, but let's assume that it does. But supposedly, I think the plan was still to have a human in the loop somewhere, because the idea of a fully automated retaliation system, even by Russian standards, sounded a bit crazy. So, I think, it's down to the point where there's, like, maybe a couple of bunkers here and there, and maybe one guy who's, like, a man decides whether or not to send the retaliation forces after learning that something has happened. You know, and there's another scary thought, which is kind of what the Russians always were trying to avoid with their multi-layered chain of command. So it ends up being, you know, some lieutenant colonel somewhere decides whether or not to press the retaliate button.
Well, that's a crazy thought. You know, there's so many places for that to go wrong. Understand their side of wanting to have, you know, some sort of retaliatory or retaliation, if you will, to something. But at the same token, you might be retaliating to something that's not there. It's a spoof.
The Russian name is, or I couldn't pronounce it, but it translated as something like dead hand, the dead hand system. So even if all the leadership has been taken out, you know, all the command bunkers destroyed, and the system is switching on, listening for signs of potential impact of nuclear bombs, at least we can launch a retaliatory strike, even though there's no one out there to do anything. So, hey, we take some comfort in that. But it sounds like a crazy plan, even by Russian standards. But I've read about it in more than one place, so it's, you know, quite possibly may exist.
4LJY. Wow, that's something else. That's more or less a scorched earth process, sounds like.
Not a fail-safe. What do you call a fail-deadly system? if we don't hear back with orders to stand down, you know, we assume the worst has happened. I think the submarine fleet basically does the same thing. You know, once you're on station, if you don't hear back, assume that you have valid orders, because, you know, everything might have been destroyed. And that's not really a good philosophy for starting a war. You worry about miscommunications. Like, there might have been, I'm sure there was a couple of movies on that subject, movies or TV series.
As soon as you said that, I thought about the Hunt for Red October. That was a pretty good movie.
October was one of them. There was another one, I think, with Denzel Washington might have been in it, where a nuclear submarine receives orders to launch at, like, Pakistan or something, but the orders are coming through in a very questionable way, like through some weird channel nobody would ever use. So when he goes to question those orders, he suddenly has the American fleet after him. It turned out there was some sort of coup attempt going on in D.C., and nobody knows who was giving orders.
It's scary, too, you know, especially when we have these carrier fleets sitting in a couple big pieces of the pond.
Versus a lot of these frontline nuclear forces, when they're given an alert, you know, some sort of emergency action message or whatever, usually they're told, usually part of the procedure is to, like, cut off all communications. And, you know, because we don't want the enemy to, you know, ignore any radio traffic that might be coming, might not be coming from us. So now you're really in the dark because you've been told to cut off communications because the enemy might be trying to recall your forces. Wasn't there things that are already like this that have happened? There was one incident in the 80s, I think, where there was some computer error that indicated this was not a movie. This may have actually happened. There was some accident which indicated an attack on the continental U.S., which was actually due to a faulty sensor or something.
That message that happened out in Hawaii, by chance?
Not only within the past 5 to 10 years. This was before that. It might have been in the early 80s. Instances. But, you know, when you're dealing with things like ballistic missiles, it's not like you have a lot of lead time to figure out whether or not something is really happening. I could probably, I read an article on this before, it's been a while ago, but there have been a few close calls where it was a question of, we're not really sure if we have real information or not.
It's bringing into question us allowing these balloons to fly over our sensitive areas, and I'm kind of curious when they put out in the news media that, I don't know why, maybe you do, that we have boomers in the area out there with this conflict going on.
These weather balloon thing? I don't know. I tend to almost believe the Chinese explanation is that some meteorological thing that got away from us and started to drift eastward or whatever. The Americans waited until they determined what it was. They waited until they determined it was no threat. And mostly they waited until it was no longer over a populated area. Because even if you're over the Nebraska cornfield and you shoot something down, it might hit something. But, yeah, that's not the first time. It's happened several times. Weather balloons are... They could be spy platforms. You never know. I tend to think it was a weather balloon.
Yeah, I guess we'll never know.
I remember reading another story. This might have been like in the north, like Minnesota or something. The the Minnesota Radio Club put out a message saying, yeah, I think one of our beacon, we had a radio beacon balloon of some sort, a Whisper, or one of those beacon balloons that we think got shot down by NORAD. So for a while, I think there was a frenzy over the initial balloon that they even took down a ham radio beacon.